Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and today we've got co-host Russ Chinelli with us, and we're going to be talking about some really important work on batteries. I'm sure you've all seen the news over the last few years of aeroplanes smoking on the runway because of the famed lithium battery. Well, what is a lithium battery? Who are the people that sort of created a lithium battery? And what are the problems with lithium batteries? We're going to be talking today with Stan Whittingham. He is a professor at SUNY in Binghamton in New York. And Stan, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you.
So before we get on to lithium batteries, the pluses, the negatives, let's talk about Stan. How did you become a scientist? What were those formative years?
I think I went to a school called Stanford School, which was very active in the sciences. And there were two great teachers there. One was a Major Lamb. He taught physics, and he just enthralled me. And then there's another fellow called Bowman, who was the chemistry faculty member, and he was also the yachting instructor. So we started a yachting club.
Well, that's a nice school. Now, this presumably was in England somewhere.
It was in England, yeah, about 100 miles north of London, a little town called Stamford. I guess built close to 1,000 years ago or something like that.
Lovely.
Notorious because the main highway to Scotland in those days went right through the center of town. And
oh.
It was one-way street in the center of towns.
That's the old A1?
The old A1, yes.
I must have gone through it hundreds of times, hitchhiking between London and Durham.
That's right.
Probably got stuck there also. Well, anyway, yes. So these two teachers, did they let you do any experiments when you were in school?
Oh, yes, we did experiments, I would say, a couple of times a week. It was a lot of hands-on experience. So we had a whole science building, which was, I think, very unusual then and probably unusual in the States even today in high schools.
Absolutely. And so what happened after you finished school? Well, you were obviously now putting on a path to science, physics, anyway,
right.
Chemistry. How did you develop the career?
They said to me, why don't you apply to Oxford? And I said, maybe. So I applied. I got into New College. And at Oxford, you study one subject, and I studied chemistry.
Good man.
And it was a whole group of exciting faculty members, some very famous ones. And at that time, materials was called metallurgy, and that was part of the chemistry department.
Well, let me ask you this question. You said you were turned on by physics, but you chose chemistry.
Well, I got turned on by both, but chemistry, you know, it's more hands-on, touchy-feely,
yep.
And it had that materials component rather than a lot of theory. So
your math skills weren't quite up to your touchy-feely skills?
Maybe, yes.
All right. So at Oxford, did you do much as the way in research when you were a young student there or not? I don't remember undergraduate career in England having an awful lot of research involved.
Well, Oxford was unique. The bachelor's program at Oxford is 4 years long, and the last year is totally research.
Oh,
so
great.
You have to write a research thesis for your undergraduate degree. And mine was intriguing. That was the beginning of the Sputnik era. And the United States Air Force was interested in what happened when atoms hit the nose cones of rockets. So they, in fact, funded my bachelor's degree work.
Just the fourth year, you mean, or the whole thing?
The fourth year.
Oh, lovely.
That's very interesting, Stan, because here we had some speakers and we have a program where there's so much rubbish up there now that it endangers the space stations, and these guys, metallurgists, were studying armor for the space stations.
Right.
And they were shooting bullets at it and that type of thing, and I didn't realize until I saw this that there was so much junk up there.
Oh, tremendous amount now. But in those days, they were just interested in, you know, little old atoms.
Yep.
And then after I finished my bachelor's degree, I decided to go on for the doctorate, and at that time, England was trying to convert coal into natural gas. So the Gas Council gave me a fellowship for my doctorate, basically working on some of the same materials. But 1 month before I started, Britain hit natural gas in the North Sea. So the gas council, we have no longer any interest. You've got your grant. Do whatever you want to do.
Oh, that was nice.
Yeah.
Well, you were a lucky man. So what did you choose to do?
Well, I, in fact, looked at what we call tungsten bronzes, which are oxide materials. They're bright metallic conductors. And looked at how they reacted with oxygen atoms, how they were reduced by hydrogen, and found out that, in fact, the ions in those materials, sodium, lithium ions, moved extremely fast. So that's what my thesis is on. And in those days, there were no computers, so you had to build your own apparatus, you know, from scratch. You had chart recorders, so you worked 24 hours a day when things were working well.
How did you choose to do the tungsten bronzes? Because you went from studying coal gasification, that was what you thought. What made you choose the tungsten bronzes? Why did you even know they existed?
Well, the tungsten bronzes, I just came across them in my bachelor's degree. So we actually looked at those for recombining the oxygen atoms, see whether they would be good catalysts to do that. So I looked at that and I said, these are interesting. Now, they're pretty colors. They're bright blues, reds, yellows, depending on how many electrons they have. And I said, no, what they're useful for. It turns out you start with some of these materials to make the tungsten filaments and light bulbs. And no one knew how this happened, so we started looking at some of those materials.
The next question I'm going to ask you is how you got to the United States, and I think I know that. And I want to say that I started my career in 1973 at Exxon, and you, through Exxon and the Materials Research Society, are the longest colleague and friends that I've had.
Yes.
So tell us how you got over.
So I think, Russ, you know how I got over. Yeah, Oxford is cloudy and rainy, and I said if I could get a postdoc position in California, I would go. And it turns out one other person had been from Oxford to Stanford. I wrote to Bob Huggins, who was then in the materials department, and said, no, you have a position. And he said, yes. So I said, I'm on the next plane over. So I busily wrote up my thesis, got on the plane, and I think I was probably the second of about eight Oxford graduates who went to Stanford University. And then I stayed there for about 4 years.
Okay, how did you get to Exxon?
That was interesting, because Stanford, I took my same bronzes over there, and we looked at them for fast iron transport, because we wanted to study some new materials that came out of Ford Motor Company called Beta Aluminas, which they were going to use as battery electrolytes. So we then used these same bronzes as electrodes, because they conducted ions and electrons, and we got two or three very good papers out of that. Then a faculty member there called Ted Jabal,
yep,
who was in Applied Physics and Materials, came and said, look, Exxon wants to hire a group of basic scientists. And it turns out at the same time Bell Labs was hiring a group of basic scientists. So about five of us got recruited from Stanford postdocs and grad students to move to New Jersey to the Exxon Labs and Bell Labs, which were about 10 miles apart at that time.
And so the person that you were introduced to was Fred Gamble.
Right. He was a newly hired group head at Exxon, and he'd worked with Ted Jabal on some superconducting materials and was working at that time for a small company next to Stanford.
You're renowned for your work on lithium batteries, right? And
yes.
You did some of the pioneering work some time ago. And yet we still see in the news on an almost regular basis some lithium battery somewhere, if not going up in flames, certainly getting very hot and causing damage and grounding aeroplanes, etc. Tell the audience, in lay terms, please, you know, what's a lithium battery as opposed to the traditional lead battery that you get in a motor car? And what are the problems associated with it?
Well, a lithium battery basically uses lithium as the energy source, but we don't use pure lithium. We store lithium in some other compound. And a lithium battery today, we store lithium either in carbon than on the other electrode in an oxide. So So we're just shuttling lithium backwards and forwards. The big plus of a lithium battery, it's about 4 volts. Compared with lead acid, it's about 2 volts, and it's about a quarter of the weight. So it stores much more energy than, say, a lead acid. So it's a very simple concept. You're shuttling lithium backwards and forwards between 2 electrodes without changing, if I can say, the crystal structure of those electrodes. So it's what we call an intercalation reaction. And your listeners may know that word from sticking February the 29th into the calendar every 4th year. The dictionary describes that as intercalating February 29th into the calendar.
That's great. So we can say that the lithium batteries are a leap into the future. They're lighter. They have a better potential that generates. So what's the problem? Why, after all these years, haven't we been able to get a safe lithium battery out there?
I would say that there are plenty of safe lithium batteries out there. I have one on my desk that we, in fact, built at Exxon in the mid-1970s as a marketing tool, and it's still operational. The issue with storing energy of any sort, it's not safe. And I and my colleagues quite often discuss, if you invented the internal combustion engine today, you would not be allowed to put 20 gallons of gas under the back seat of your car.
Yeah.
It's all a perception. So, no, as far as I know, no one has been killed or seriously hurt in the U.S. with a lithium battery. Each year, somewhere around 300 people are killed by their gas tank catching fire, just all by itself, not in an accident or anything else. So it's more perception than anything else. And a few years ago, you heard about laptops catching fire, and I think it was just then, at that time, the vendors were pushing for too much energy in the volume available and cutting corners.
So you would imply then that's what's happening nowadays in modern airliners, that they're just trying to get too much out of too little, and therefore they should have more larger lithium batteries rather than a smaller number of smaller ones.
Yeah, this is the big debate. A Tesla car has several thousand small batteries. The Boeing 787 had, I think, 6 larger batteries. But the Boeing ones are handmade, I would say right now, badly designed, and they've contained the problem. There's some inherent issues in the Boeing in batteries, which are, if you look at laptops where there are billions made every year, those problems, I think, have essentially gone away.
Well, I can remember that back then we did have problems with the electrolyte, and there was some explosions around the world.
And the
issue has been, and you've been a big contributor to solving that problem, has been the electrolyte. So why don't you talk a little bit about how you get the lithium across? Talk about that.
Yeah. Well, I should say Russ is the expert on this. The big issue with the electrolyte and the anode.
Hang on a minute. That's very disappointing. But we'll take a break for one moment. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Russ Chiannelli, famous lithium battery entrepreneur. And we're also interviewing Dr. Stan Whittingham. He's from State University of New York in Binghamton and one of the pioneers in the area of lithium batteries. We'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chiannelli, talking with Stan Whittingham. He's from the State University of New York in Binghamton and one of the pioneers in the area, as we were saying, of lithium batteries. And we're talking about, you know, the transfer of lithium from one electrode to the other, transferring the charge, but it has to go through something, and that's called the electrolyte. And Russ asked the question, are there still problems with electrolytes? Because he remembers there was, and they used to explode. So, Stan, follow up.
Yes, there are still continuing problems with the electrolyte, but I think it's mostly been solved by changing the anode. In the old days, we used to use pure lithium. When you recharge these batteries, you form dendrites. These are long, spiky forms, look somewhat like snowflakes that go through the electrolyte, through the separator, and short out the battery. By using other materials, so we store the lithium now within carbon, that problem has almost totally gone away. But we also have made some changes in the electrolyte. So in the original days, we used ether-based electrolytes, and today they're mostly carbonate-based electrolytes, but the electrolytes are still, in the end, the major cause of fires. Once the battery gets overheated, those electrolytes are organic materials. They will burn just like gasoline will burn, but not quite as fast. So there's still some issues with the electrolyte.
And isn't it the case that there's some solid-state electrolytes being considered rather than a liquid?
Yes, a number of companies are looking at using solid electrolytes, solid all components, the anode, the electrolyte, and the cathode, and those will be inherently much safer, but they'll have very low power density because you can't get the ions through the solid electrolyte very fast. And that really hasn't changed since the 1970s. We have got no better materials than we had back then for the solid electrolytes.
Let's go back to the dendrimers, the dendrites. And I remember many years ago going to a big Phelps Dodge refinery, copper refinery here in town, and I watched them doing the electrolytic refining of copper. And I also saw that into each of the electrolytic tanks, and there were hundreds of them, were dripping in on a constant basis animal glue. It came straight from pork factories, pig factories, meat factories, let me correct that. And they were saying, well, the animal glue contained all sorts of proteins that stopped the formation of these dendrites. Now, tell us, because it's important when you get the dendrites, you know, the two electrodes can get closer together and that causes havoc. Why do they form, and what is it that in lithium batteries you've been able to do to stop their formation?
Well, I think that they form because as soon as you get a protuberance, a little raising of one of the electrodes, it's then closer to the other electrode, so you've got a higher electric field, so that protuberance grows faster than anything else, so that starts a dendrite growing.
I have beautiful pictures of them. And
right.
To me, it was a standard sort of crystal growth when you tried to precipitate something back out.
So it's just a matter of really non-planar surfaces, irregular surfaces of the electrodes.
That's correct.
So what does one do to try to stop that from happening?
Well, the simplest approach and the approach used now is you never have pure lithium, so you can't start the growth.
Okay.
So you store the lithium. Exxon did it. They stored it in aluminum. Today it's stored in
carbon, I think you said.
In carbon, right. And people are looking at tin and silicon. But it means you mustn't charge too fast, or you can still make lithium and you can still make dendrites.
Where do you think these batteries are ready to go? Where will you focus your research to improve them now?
Today, if you look at the batteries on the market, they only have about 20% of the theoretical capacity, so they're very low relative to what they could be. So a lot of our studies are looking at the basic chemical reactions that occur and trying to improve them so we can at least double the storage capability. And the other thing is to get all that carbon out of there and put something else in the place, because the carbon takes up half the volume of a lithium battery.
It lowers the density, yeah.
Yeah, it's very low density. So we're looking at tin-based materials. Most people are looking at silicon-based materials, and that's going to be the future. I don't think anybody's going to go to pure lithium just because of the hazards, at least for the next 10 years or so.
Explain, Stan, please, this business of efficiency. You say that you can only get 40% at best, I gather, of the energy. What causes that loss? Is it that the heat that's being generated? Or where does that energy that you think should be there to be recouped, where is it going?
Well, let's look at the difference between what we get out and efficiency. You can get about 20% of the theoretical capacity. That capacity is still well over 90% efficient. So if the actual weight of the battery, two-thirds of it or half of it is dead weight. It doesn't do anything for you. It's dead volume. And of the real materials, the carbon and the oxides, you're still only using those to about 50 or 60%. So our goals are to use the active materials fully and get better materials so we don't have to have each electrode so thin. If we can make them thicker, then we can get rid of some of the dead material in there. So you can term it as it's the packaging that needs improving.
And what about the lifetimes? The lifetimes are pretty good. As you were saying, you still have one operating on your desk.
Right. So lifetimes depend very much on how much you use it and how rigorously you use it. So I think in Binghamton, we have a company called BAE Systems, which has somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 hybrid buses on the road. And these all use lithium-ion batteries. And they're thinking that those batteries last 2 or 3 years, but they get really punished in regenerative braking and acceleration. A good laptop battery will probably last you 5 years.
We used to have somebody back there that talked about zinc-bromine liquid batteries, right? You remember that?
Yes.
Okay, and I've heard that they're coming back. The liquid batteries are coming back. I was at Sandia recently, and they started talking about flow batteries. Could you describe a little bit whether you think they're coming back, or what's the advantage?
The one big issue out there today is still cost. So if you want a huge battery for grid purposes, you may go to a flow battery where you can separate the amount you store from the electrochemical system. And flow batteries are probably a possible answer there. And people are still looking at zinc bromine, but I think there's an issue on the toxicity of the bromine. There's a huge push on zinc air batteries right now. It's large, rechargeable, and obviously on vanadium redox are there. So I think where you've got a stationary, where you can build basically a stationary chemical plant as a battery, they have a chance there, but for smaller systems, lithium ion is winning out. So there are 8 megawatt systems that used to be here. There's a, I think, 16 megawatt system in West Virginia for a wind farm. And lithium has the advantage you can put it on the back of a truck and haul it to wherever you can make more money quickly. The flow systems will be
permanent. Yeah.
Banned.
But this is an issue for solar energy, right? How do you store it in your home overnight when you need it, rather than use the electric company as your battery?
Right. And Musk and Tesla, I think, claim they've solved that problem. And no, you can buy a large battery from them for about $3,000 now, which is substantially below what the market price used to be. And that's basically ready to go to hang on the wall in your garage or your solar system.
That brings up an interesting point. You made the important point just now that you will drag your battery to where you can make money, all right? And yet this gentleman from Tesla is sort of basically giving away lots of his technology in order to be able to increase the potential for electric cars and all sorts of other electric motors. Talk about that for a little bit. This sort of, the one hand, you know, industry and society needs companies to make money, but on the other hand, there's the other that says, "Hey, don't always concentrate on the money. Look, I'm going to give you this technology and let it go out there and make better lives."
Yeah, I think, you know, he's got things right. He's got to build the electric vehicle market first, then he can make money on it. And so if he gives away the electric vehicle technology, then maybe the Fords, the GMs, and the Chrysler will pick it up and run also, and that's going to help his market. And clearly, if he can sell millions of these garage energy storage systems, that will make his gigafactory profitable in the end.
Okay, but I mean, that also stands the risk of, you know, once Ford, Chrysler, Fiat, and all these others,
well, I wanted to
he'll be sunk. Right.
I want to ask Stan if he's been talking to Apple. Apple says they're bringing out an electric car.
Well, you've got this non-driver car, you know, where you don't do anything. You just sit in it and tell it where to go.
Yeah.
But if that gets hacked, right, and any computer can get hacked, you'll say, "I want to go to San Francisco," and you'll land up in Manitoba. And you can't do anything about it. Does that interest you, Stan, that sort of area of complete driverless cars?
Well, I think it's the obvious way for the future in towns and things, where you could get your iPhone, call up and say, "I want a car." It would come pick you up. You'd get out of it, and then it would go off somewhere else. So you wouldn't even own it in that case. It has pluses on places. I look at For example, the Bayshore Freeway from San Francisco to San Jose. It's stop and go, but there's absolutely no reason why it's stop and go, because somebody slowed down. If they were all automated and all went at the same speed, the traffic would flow much better.
Well, if it comes about, Stan, sell any stock you have in insurance companies, right? Because there's supposed to be no accidents. And that's a big part of the American economy. We've got a couple of minutes left. What intrigues you about your near-term future and our near-term future as a society?
We're talking about lithium batteries, and I think there's a huge opportunity there for helping renewable energy, reducing CO2, and making it cleaner and easier for everybody. No one can do without their iPhone or iPad or the computer these days, and without the battery, you wouldn't have those. So I see us going more down that track, less of the polluting vehicles, less of our coal power plants.
And we can finally start using petroleum for something better than just burning it, right?
What about hydrogen storage?
Well, we had a bus through here the other day, which is similar to the lithium buses. They took the diesel engine out and put fuel cell in and hydrogen storage. The big question of hydrogen storage is, where does the hydrogen come from on a large scale? And how safe is it to ship it?
Well, that's another program. We've got to stop there. Stan Whittingham, State University of New York in Binghamton. We'd like to thank you very much for being on Science Studio.
Thanks very much, Dan, and we hope that you come back to Science Studio, and thanks to Norma Martinez, our producer.
Thank you.
Okay, and so everybody out there, be back next week for another Science Studio, because we'll be here. Bye-bye.